Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, the healing power of music. Music is one of humanity's oldest medicines, from the Far East to the Ottoman Empire, Europe to Africa and the pre-colonial Americas. Many cultures have developed their own rich traditions for using sound and rhythm to ease suffering, promote healing, and calm the mind. Neuroscientist and New York Times bestselling author of This Is Your Brain on Music, Daniel Levitin, reveals the deep connections between music and healing in his new book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Mindy.
So we all know music can transport us to another time. It can pump us up. It can relax us. And I think we've all had that experience of this euphoric sensation when we listen to a song that we really love. A lot of things happening in our brains, right? And you write, engaging with music, whether as a listener or a player, facilitates entry into the brain's default mode network, a path to the subconscious that is instrumental to everything from problem solving to relaxation, from creativity to immune system function. Tell us more about this default mode network.
Wow, that was a run-on sentence I wrote. I should be ashamed of myself. I think most of the sentences in the book are shorter than that. Before we get to the default, I think I'll leverage something you said. You were talking about how music can transport us to another time. It can certainly transport us to another place very effectively. I was in Istanbul earlier this week, Constantinople.
Wow.
You mentioned the Ottoman Empire. And the music there is quite different than ours. And five different times throughout the day, coming over loudspeakers from the various mosques as the Qawwali singing and the call to prayer. And that very distinctive sound, I mean, you all know it, I can't really do it, but it's it transports you to another time and another place. I was recollecting from that sound the sounds of being in Jerusalem and the sounds of the mosques there. And now, as I remember it, my default mode network is the part of my brain that is loosely associating thoughts and not consciously directing them. And it's bringing all those experiences back to me. So the default mode network was discovered by my colleague Vinod Menon at Stanford. And what he found was when the brain is not actively trying to achieve a goal, it goes somewhere else, and that somewhere else is daydreaming. And daydreaming is necessary. So many of us these days in our over-caffeinated world fight it off.
Oh, I love daydreaming.
Well, this is why you are able to do what you do. But people who insist on plowing through with another cup of coffee or something are actually doing their brains and their work a disservice. We need downtime. And the default mode network is one of the things that evolution evolved to serve that purpose. And one of the most reliable ways to get into it, besides meditation, prayer, is listening to music or playing music.
Yeah. There's so much brain science in this book. I know I'm not going to be able to cover everything. I'll have to read about it. But one of the other areas I found really interesting was your conversation about memory and forgetting, which are connected. And you have this great story about Ella Fitzgerald in the book.
Ella was doing a concert, a famous concert in 1959 or 1960 in Berlin. And she wanted to introduce a song that she hadn't sung before to a live audience, Mack the Knife, which had previously been a hit from the Three Penny Opera. And she forgets the words. And it's become a very famous recording, Ella Live in Berlin, particularly Mack the Knife, because what she does when she forgets the words is both so elegant and so instructive to all of us about the way memory works. There's this old saw in cognitive psychology that we were all brought up on when we went to college, and that I learned there not far down the road from you when I was a student at MIT, which is that the best way to understand the brain is to find cases where it doesn't work right. Look for funny little malfunctions. That's why I'm sure most of our listeners at some point took an intro psychology class, and you probably saw visual illusions. You know, like is it a bunny or is it a duck? And are the tracks really parallel or are they diverging? You know, and those visual illusions are telling us a lot about our visual system, how we can trick it. And you know, by studying how it tries to function when it's failing, we learn a whole lot.
Yeah.
So that was the case with Ella. Ella forgot the words, but she didn't forget the rhythm. It's not like the representation of the song in her brain suddenly disappeared, the entirety of it. It was bits and pieces. She forgot the words, she remembered the rhythm, she remembered the melody, she remembered the key they were in, she remembered the tempo. So she just keeps singing along, making up words as she goes. And she even remembers the rhyme scheme. So the last line of every verse line that she's singing is in the correct rhyme scheme. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when we talk about memory and this it being connected to forgetting, sometimes we think, well, did I even really remember that to begin with, right? And we have false memories all the time.
We do. False memories are more common than we think. You know, Elizabeth Loftus, who's a famous cognitive psychologist, has made a career out of showing how eyewitness testimony can be manipulated and we actually remember things. And I write in the book about 80% of Americans have a false memory of the films they saw during 9/11, the Twin Towers. We remember seeing Tower 1 come down and then video footage of Tower 2, but the Tower 1 footage wasn't available until an entire day later.
Yeah.
But our brains kind of restitch together the timeline and give us this compelling narrative of what actually happened in the world, but not what actually happened in our sensory world.
Yeah.
And so false memories happen all the time. People misremember lyrics, they misremember music, they misidentify music. But it's another interesting thing. It's, as Danny Kahneman used to say, he was one of my mentors and won the Nobel Prize in economics for his work in decision making. Danny used to say, you know, the brain is a bunch of special purpose modules designed to accomplish particular tasks. They don't always work together well, and they don't always handle more complicated tasks.
Yeah. We're talking with Daniel Levitin. His book is I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. We'll talk more after break.
The late Warren Hiller of Marion remembers the hurricane of 38.
It's the worst thing. Oh, devastated all the properties. It wasn't only Marion. It was Wareham, it was Mattapoisett. The whole area was wiped. All the power lines were down. All the trees were down. The boats all, the water came up. Oh, unbelievable. They just washed off everything. Then the undertow was even worse. When the water starts going back, the whole waterfront was devastated. The boats were all up on they're all up on the land. They're all up on the middle of Front Street, all over the place. And Tabor Academy up in the ball field. Oh, the wharfs were gone. Everything was completely gone. You know, it's like being in the wilderness. It was real treachery.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Daniel Levitin. His book is I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. So what's happening in our brains when we think we have this memory, and is our brain is what, recreating sometimes, looking for patterns? I mean, what's happening in our brains that makes us remember something that isn't actually what happened?
If nothing else, our brain is a giant prediction machine. It's trying to figure out what is going to happen next in the world. And do I need to jump out of the way, or do I need to grab that piece of fruit before another simian does? That sort of thing. And what that means is we need to look for patterns. And the brain is excellent at finding patterns. When you, as a kid, lay on your back and you stared up at the clouds and you would see shapes in it, that was your default mode network finding patterns where none really existed. Mm-hmm. And so music is this tremendously rewarding game of play for the brain, because it is patterned, unless you're talking about the odd case of like 12-tone serial music by Schoenberg, which is, you know, written randomly. Music has structure, and it's the brain's delight to try and figure out what note will come next.
Yeah. And so it's not surprising that when we think about this, that we remember experiences differently, especially in siblings, right? No, that's not how it happened. Yes, it is. This is what happened, right? Because you're so sure your memory is correct and your sibling remembers it differently. So that kind of explains how you both could have a different memory.
Well, that also, but siblings are different, are different in other ways. Unless you're identical twins, birth order makes a difference in how your parents treat you most of the time. And if you've got more than one sibling, you know, two or three, they all treat you differently depending on your birth order and your birth order and your relationship with them and your personality. My sister and I have 50% of our genes in common, and we look alike, but we're very different personalities. And that causes the world to engage with us differently. Yeah. So the idea that memory is different for siblings, I think, is bound up with this idea that the world is treating them differently. And memories are primarily emotional, Mindy. The most reliable way to get something into memory is to make it emotional. We tend to remember things that had some emotional impact on us. And two siblings can have a different story just because the emotional impact of the event was very different.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. Dad gave you a pony. That's a very different emotional impact.
Yeah, exactly. And, I didn't really think about this, surprised to learn that there, you know, there's different kinds of memory, right?
There are. And the inventory is long, but some of the obvious ones are, we have autobiographical memory, memory for things we've done, first person memories. And those are in a separate store. And we know this because people with brain damage or lesions, a stroke, can suffer a loss of autobiographical memory. They forget who they are, or they forget particular portions of their lives. Semantic memory, which is your memory for knowledge and facts, is a separate store. So, I mean, it's called that because it's the meaning of words, but it's also the meaning of facts, like, a year is 365 days, and the sun is 93 million miles away, and it takes 8 minutes for the light to get here. Those are facts. Massachusetts is a commonwealth, not a simple state. But then we have, separate from that, a memory for social events. And we have a memory for musical events and a speech store, you know, auditory memory.
Mm-hmm. And you tell some great stories about, you know, impacts from the brain. You tell a story of a woman named Roseanne who had debilitating headaches, and she had to have the surgery. She lost her ability to play the piano. Yet she.
Oh, this was Roseanne Cash.
Yeah. Oh, was it Roseanne Cash? Okay. Yeah. Right. And she relearned how to play the piano. And it kind of, you know, she got it back more quickly than it was originally to learn this. Right. So it's interesting when you have these brain injuries and certain, the things that happen musically after, you know, what you can and cannot do. And you give several examples of several stories, and this was one of them. But what is that is it your brain kind of, as you're starting to relearn this, your brain goes, oh, wait a minute, this is familiar. I mean, why does it happen quickly when it didn't happen so quickly when they originally learned it?
Great question. So you want a long answer or a short answer?
Whatever the answer is.
This goes back to some experiments done nearly 100 years ago by Paul Kohlers, where he taught people to read mirror writing or upside down writing, or, you know, paragraphs that were both upside down and mirror image. And it took them a while. You know, you've got to reorient yourself. However long it took a couple of weeks, they got pretty good at it. He has them come back in the laboratory years later. They're terrible at it, of course, but the amount of time they had to practice was just a fraction of what it took them to learn it in the first place. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks in the first instance, maybe an hour of practice, and they're back where they were before. It's the nature of how memories are made. When we're making a memory, particularly if we're memorizing a motor sequence, like how to ride a bicycle, play the piano, if you're an actor and you've memorized Macbeth, it's heavy lifting. It's pure rote. It's doing it over and over and over and over again until the brain's pathways for those actions and thoughts become very, very strong. And building new neural pathways happens throughout the lifespan. You're doing that right up to the very end. Your brain never stops building new neural pathways. It becomes more difficult to do when you're older. Mm-hmm. Just everything slows down. But once those neural pathways are built, you might lose access to where they are in the brain. But once you can access them again, you can re-energize them in a short amount of time.
Does muscle memory play a role in that?
Muscle memory is just another name for this, and I want to clarify it because I know so many pianists, and I'm a pianist myself, it does feel like Beethoven is in the fingers, mm-hmm. but he's not. Yeah. I mean, if I scoop your brain out of your head, you're not going to be able to play. So there's a representation of the fingers and the hands and the muscles in the brain, and you can call that muscle memory, but why? It's memory.
Yeah.
It's memory for the muscle movements.
It's interesting. I think back to, I don't play the piano anymore, but as a kid, you know, my mother taught me this piece of music that if you put that sheet music in front of me, I would be like, there's no way I could play that, right? But that's the only thing that I can play on the piano without looking at something. And I think, is it because the brain was young then and, you know, it just sticks in there? Because there is not another song. I played many as a kid, but that one my mother taught me without sheet music is the one I can still play.
Well, so there's two things going on there. One is playing by ear, as you did, uses different neural circuitry than trying to read the music. Mm. Just like telling a story is different than reading the story.
Right.
And so, you know, you sometimes see stand-up comedians with their notes and they're reading it, and it's almost never as good as when they're just, you know, free-forming it.
Right.
So the other factor is the memories that get in your brain early tend to be the strongest, which is why in old age homes we see with cognitive decline, dementia, Alzheimer's, people may not remember the last 30 years, but they remember their youth as though it was yesterday.
Right. Yeah.
Computer science, because you're in Woods Hole, I'll use a computer science analogy. When computer scientists talk about memory storage in computers, there's a called a FIFO principle and a FILO principle. First in, first out is the way some memory storage works, but memory is FILO, first in, last out. First memories in are the last ones to go.
Hmm. And there's also, a difference in attention that plays a role, right? You did an experiment presenting 50 songs to 460 people, and you write, our experiment found that about half the songs were reliably identified by rhythm alone, another half by melody alone with some overlap. What does that tell us?
Well, so I was just interested to know what songs people could recognize just on the rhythm. Versus just on the melody where you kept the rhythm steady. And I'll give you a little example here. So here's a song that many of our listeners may recognize just from the rhythm.
I don't know.
Da-da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-dum,
oh, dum-dum. Oh, that, yeah. The Lone Ranger theme.
Right, from the
yeah.
Puccini opera.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most, not everybody, but you know, 75% of our participants could identify that. Deck the halls with boughs of.
It's like I'm saying it's familiar. What is it?
Well, exactly. And a lot of people just said, well, that's a Christmas song. And they couldn't get, but you know, there's again, like the Ella story, there's something there. Right. Something's getting, it's Christmas music. And the other people who couldn't identify the Lone Ranger said, isn't that from a TV show or something, you know?
So, so I sort of got it, yeah.
But then you've got things where you play the rhythm and people are clueless. Here's one. But once I start singing it, da 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 da, Beethoven's Ninth. Yeah. So it turns out that, you know, in trying to figure out what's memorable about music, it's almost always the whole package. But some elements of music are more memorable than others. And you can't say that rhythm is more memorable than melody or vice versa. It depends. Mm-hmm. It depends on how distinctive the rhythm is and how distinctive the melody is. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole, I think, angle, approach of thinking about distinctiveness of cues that our research community has more or less ignored all this time.
Right. All right. You say the insula is one of your favorite brain parts. So tell us what that is and why you find it so fascinating.
The insular cortex is the part of the brain directly below the crown of your head, maybe an inch and a half down. And it contains a switch. And Vinod Menon at Stanford and I were the first researchers to identify where that switch is exactly in the brain. And it's the switch between the default mode network and the central executive network. We haven't used that term before, but central executive is the part of your brain that keeps you on task. If you're driving a car, it keeps you focused on the road. If you're at work, it keeps you focused on your work. Default mode is daydreaming, and the insula switches back and forth. And you can't be in both at once. Mm-hmm. It's really an on-off switch, not a fader.
Okay. Here's a bit of a surprise. You write, statistically speaking, a song so popular that most people like it is very, very rare. I found that surprising. I guess it's like art subjective, right?
Music is very subjective. I talk a lot in the book about how the healing powers of music and the power of music to restore us and to boost our immune system so we don't get sick in the first place depends on listening to music you like. And very, very subjective. There is no one song that everybody likes. There's no one song everybody hates. And what we like and hate changes throughout the lifespan. Mm-hmm. Songs that I used to play over and over again when I was a teenager and loved, I'm just kind of worn out on them. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what they're gonna do. There's not enough surprise in there. Interestingly though, unlike the case of the Beatles, where it's so densely packed with musical ideas, that even on listening to something for maybe the 5,000th time, I'll discover something new. It's more like a symphony in that respect. Mm-hmm. The idea is that, if you just take the bass lines alone in Beatles music and listen to them, they are entire songs. They're very melodic. Yeah. Any lesser musician would have said, I'm not gonna waste that great idea on a bass line, I'm gonna write a song. But if you're Paul McCartney and you have an unlimited well of ideas, you can squander them on a bass line.
Well, that explains why I never get tired of Beatles music. It's the one thing I can listen to anytime, right? On this program, we often talk about the amazing impact of exercise, and you note that movement disorders don't just affect our locomotion, they affect our cognition. Older adults who find themselves slipping into cognitive decline and have to have a hip or a knee replaced discover they were not on the brink of dementia, they just weren't moving around enough to keep their brains sharp. So part of the benefit of simple movement is healthy oxygenation of blood to the brain. But more important, it feeds cognitive capacity. Again, like movement is key. And doesn't music make us move, right?
Well, so yeah, music is one of the, probably the only art that makes you want to shake your pudendum. It makes you want to move. And it's because there are direct circuits between the auditory cortex and the movement centers of the brain. And not initially having to do with music, but because of the startle reflex. If you hear a sudden loud sound, you want to get out of the way and you have to jump before you stop and think about it. So music evolved and scaffolds on that system to get us wiggling our bodies. And I had dinner last night with Scott Grafton, who is a big proponent of this idea of embodied cognition, that if you don't move and interact with the world, you're not feeding your brain what it needs. He wrote a wonderful book called Physical Intelligence that I highly recommend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had also some interesting research on stuttering, and I guess you use Miltilis as a really good example of that. Here's a guy who speaks with a stutter but sings beautifully, no stutter.
Yeah, so stuttering is a kind of movement disorder. Good segue there. So and like Parkinson's disease, it's a disorder of voluntary movement and timing. And so it's not that the stutterer doesn't know what the words are, it's that they can't get the articulatory system, lips, the jaw, the tongue, the larynx, to work together to create them in the right sequence, and they get stuck. But music has this intrinsic tempo that acts as a kind of a guide. So once the music starts going, you know where the beat is. Your brain doesn't have to manufacture it. And that's what allows stutterers to sing. Elvis Presley, by the way, was famously a stutterer.
Yeah. You also talk about group drumming, which has been pretty popular. And it's because what it bypasses language centers. Talk about just that rhythm and how that can be a healing thing.
Well, group drumming is a form of music therapy, and it involves moving your body in time to music, even if you're not a drummer. It's oxygenating, it's aerobic, it's challenging because it's asking your brain to anticipate what's going to happen next and create your movement in such a precise way that you'll make a sound right when everybody else is making a sound. Mm-hmm. It pulls you outside yourself, right? You can't just be off in your own world. You've got to be attending to the world around you and the people around you. And that's helpful.
Yeah. Does it work for other instruments as well? Or is it kind of specifically a drumming thing?
Oh, I think playing any instrument has those effects. Drumming is just more accessible to many people. Yeah. And it's more primal.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I know you're a musician as well, and maybe a decade ago, I was taking mandolin lessons, and some of it I was reading from sheet music, and some of it learning, again, a song, by ear, and sometimes you get stuck, right? I'd get stuck, and my mandolin teacher would say, stop, tell me a story, and I'd be like, what do you mean, like a reboot, right? He'd be, stop, and then you'd stop,
Oh, right.
You'd have that just second of, away from thinking about the music, and all of a sudden you can play it.
Right.
What's happening in your brain?
I don't know.
Just a little reboot. It just needed a reboot, right?
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, it's a classic case if you step away from any kind of problem and you come back to it a minute later, an hour later, a day later, and you get the answer. The brain does get sort of stuck in these loops. And you have to get out of the loop and take a broader perspective. Danny Kahneman, who I mentioned earlier, used to take walks every time he got stuck. Mm. And I've started doing that. And even when I don't think I'm stuck, I'll take a walk. And when I get back to my work, things seem different and better.
Yeah.
And I'm more focused on what I need to do. It's that default mode network kicking in.
Yeah.
By the way, you mentioned reading sheet music. That's a kind of a special artificial and recent invention. We've only had written music for less than 500 years. And the idea of trying to translate dots on a page to muscle movements adds a layer of complexity. It's not it's not easy to learn, and when you don't stay in practice, it's easy to lose it.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I was a kid and I took piano lessons, I had a piano teacher who taught chords. So, you know, I'm playing the melody on one hand and chords on the other. So I never learned to read the music on them. But once I started playing the mandolin, that made a whole, now I could read the whole thing, which is, I thought was interesting, because I had a very difficult time with the piano trying to read, you know, the chord hand versus the melody hand, you know.
Are you reading tablature where they show you where to put the fingers, or are you reading actual notes?
Actual notes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very... It's
of course, the advantage is on the mandolin, you've got four notes.
That yeah, you can, yeah, true. That's
basically
very true.
Four strings and octaves, and the piano has 88 keys, so...
That may be why it was easier, right? We're talking with Daniel Levitin. His book is I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Daniel Levitin. His book is I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. You talk about music and the impact of a number of disorders in the book, like Parkinson's, Huntington's, trauma, PTSD, and others. I want to talk a little bit about dementia, because that is like an area a lot of people, there's a lot of conversation about. And you mentioned even in like some of the assisted living places where people come in and play music. And we find sometimes the folks with dementia who are no longer verbal, the musicians come in and they're singing along. And I know family members get very surprised at that. They're like, they can't speak, but yet they can still sing these songs. What is happening?
Music and language are separate systems. They evolved as separate systems. I mean, they come together. We have music with lyrics, but they're still separate systems. And the music lyric system in the brain is separate from the talking system in the brain. And we saw this most clearly, as I describe in the book, with Gabby Giffords,
right,
who after she was shot in the head in Tucson, I think it was 2011, lost her ability to speak utterly. And they used music therapy, a program called melodic intonation therapy, where they teach the patient to sing what their basic needs are. And patients can sing these things in a relatively short time because in general, the music system has been spared, not in all cases, but you know, if you're a candidate for this therapy, I mean, your music system's intact. You still can respond to music and you can still sing. So she would sing basic requests like, I'd like a glass of water, or show me to the bathroom. And gradually through practicing that, she built up the capacity to say those words without having to sing them, kind of creating a supplementary system. The brain is massively redundant. There are all these different ways of doing things. And one of the interesting things about Alzheimer's that you mentioned is that Alzheimer's often goes unnoticed and undetected for years because the brain figures out workarounds. It knows that it can't do what it's trying to do, and there are all these supplementary circuits, and so it uses them. And then when the supplementary circuit starts to go, that's when you have the problem.
Yeah. I think you tell a story in the book about a guy who's under the sink looking at the pipes, and his daughter's like, what are you doing? And he can't remember what the wrench, I think he was holding, he can't remember what it's for. And she thinks he's dehydrated and gets him something. And they sort of think, well, and it's a while before they realize that that was, you know, some of the early signs that he was suffering from Alzheimer's. But it's like, and I think that's a thing we have as we get a little bit older. You know, I'm at the point where I forget people's names, or, you know, forget little things. But it's not the same as, like, you have your car keys, you know what they're for. And it would be more of a, what are these things and what do they do, right? It's a different kind of forgetting.
Yeah, so we all forget names. We all forget words. As a professor, I can tell you 20-year-olds are forgetting names and words all the time. It's just that when they do it, they've got a different narrative about it. They say, oh, well, you know, I had too much to drink last night, or I only got 4 hours sleep, or I'm taking six classes, whatever. Right. When it happens to somebody my age, we go, oh, my God, this is Alzheimer's. This is the beginning of the end.
Right.
But it's the same behavior with a different narrative. But the joke is that If you forget the word for the keys, that's not Alzheimer's. If you forget what the key is for, that might be Alzheimer's.
That's when you have trouble, yeah. I thought this was this kind of goes back to being subjective about the music, but a recent finding is self-chosen music is more effective than music chosen by others.
Absolutely, because musical taste is subjective. And I'm, you know, the context for this is if you're in a hospital or in a dentist's office or you're getting some sort of therapy and somebody says, well, this is the music that's going to cure you, and you don't have any say in it, that can be very aversive. Yeah. One of the things people complain about in daily modern life is the most aversive thing is unwanted music piped into public places. We have particular taste about it. It'd be like forcing somebody to eat some food they didn't want to eat, you know?
Yeah. Also, it's interesting, the effect of music on pain. And music is effective for both short-term and long-term pain, even though there's like different parts of the brain that are creating the, or, you know, having you feel the pain, right? There's different parts of the brain, but music works on both.
Music works on acute pain, short-term pain, and chronic pain. And the mechanism for that with, you know, my lab was the first to discover that when you listen to music you like, mm-hmm. your brain produces its own internal opioids, analgesics, and not in the same pharmaceutical levels as you might get in an OxyContin, but, you know, some opioids. And so pleasurable music can give you that analgesic effect.
Yeah. So it's more than just distraction, because obviously distraction is helpful, but if your brain is, but once you stop with the distraction, stop with the music, does it last longer? And it does, right? I mean, that
so this
relief.
This is fiendishly difficult to study, and I've tried to do this several times to distinguish the effect of the distractibility of music versus the pleasure chemical producing aspect of it. And the problem, as many of your smart listeners have probably anticipated, is I can play you music that I know is pleasurable. How do I know whether it's distracting you as well? And I can play you music that isn't pleasurable, but it's going to be less likely to distract you because you're going to tune it out. Mm-hmm. And so it's complicated.
Yeah. What about people who are tone deaf?
You know, we use that term incorrectly, I think. Mm-hmm. Most people are not tone deaf. They can tell the difference between bah and ah. They're tune deaf. They can't recognize tunes or they can't sing tunes. And it's really a constellation of different impairments, if you will. Some people can recognize tunes just fine. They can't sing them because they may lack the fine muscle control in their throats necessary to create the right pitches. Or maybe, although they can recognize the tune, which is called recognition memory, they can't reproduce it, which is a separate memory system. We were talking earlier about memory systems. Recognition memory, seeing or hearing something that you've experienced before and knowing that it's familiar and then being able to identify it, that's separate than being able to reproduce something. I don't have reproduction memory for the Mona Lisa. I can't draw it for you, but I certainly have recognition memory. So the point of that is what? It's it's that, boy, I really did lose my...
No, so it doesn't matter if you can't sing it or whatever. I mean, the healing power of music will work with anybody, right?
Sorry, I lost
yeah.
I lost
That's
the thread
okay.
there. So we're talking about tone deafness, and tone deafness can arise from not being able to have the ability to reproduce something. That could be because you don't have an accurate enough mental image of it. And then there are some people who really can't distinguish one tone from another, and that's quite rare.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about all of these different like emotions that music can do, and it can relax us and, like I said, pump us up and whatever, how far does the healing power of music go? What can it heal and what can it not?
Heal is probably the wrong word. If you've got a burn or a gash in your arm, it's not going to heal it.
Right.
If you've got cancer, it's not going to heal it. But it can treat the symptoms. And so I think the best example, Mindy, is Parkinson's. At some point with Parkinson's, a neurodegenerative disease, many patients can no longer walk. They get stuck. And that's because the timing circuit in their brain that tells them when to put one foot in front of the other, similar to the circuit used for speech and the case of stuttering, that's degraded. But if you play a Parkinson's patient who can't walk music that has the tempo of their natural walking speed, their gait, populations of millions of neurons will synchronize with that tempo, unimpaired neurons. And then the patient is able to walk because the motor system latches onto this and puts one foot in front of the other.
Fascinating. Is there a difference in playing versus listening to music?
There is. Of course, playing is active. Listening is passive, relatively speaking. It doesn't have to be. You can be active. We talk about active listening, really immersing yourself and try to figure out what's happening and what's going to happen next. But playing is, you know, you're using your own body to create music. And what we've seen actuarially is that musicians tend to live longer than non-musicians. There is a lot that's neuroprotective about the eye-hand coordination that's required. Music making is generally a social experience. You're not generally making it entirely by yourself. And just, it requires constant rewiring of the brain. I listened to several performances of one of my favorite pianists, Daniel Barenboim, playing Beethoven sonatas. And over the course of his life, he never played them the same way twice. Why would he? Why would he bother? Each time he plays it, I'm certain he's looking for a new take on the story of the song. Mm. And that is creating new neural pathways. It's stimulating, it's promoting new neural growth. So playing music is different and better.
Does it matter?
It's never too late to learn.
That's my next question. How old is too old? There's no such thing, right? You could do it anytime?
No such thing. My grandmother started playing the piano when she was 80. Mm. And I know a number of people who just picked up, you know, we were talking about Scott Grafton earlier, my colleague who is a neurologist and neuroscientist and looks at physical intelligence and embodied cognition. He's 68. He started playing the banjo when he was 60. Wow. And he is really good.
Wow. And does it matter what instrument? It's all any musical instrument?
You know, I would say that it depends on how committed you are to the endeavor and what your tolerance for frustration is. The least frustrating instrument is the piano, mm-hmm. because it's all laid out there in front of you, and you today can sit down and play a C sharp as well as Daniel Barenboim or Billy Joel, and you know, nobody would know that it was you or them. It's putting the notes together that's the challenge, of course, but the tone is not a problem. Getting a good tone out of a violin can take a long time. Coordinating the left and the right hand on a guitar or a mandolin can take a while, and you've got to build up calluses on the guitar. So people like the guitar because it's the pop music engine. It's the instrument of defiance and rock and roll, but it's a frustrating instrument to learn in later life.
Yeah, I also think watching music live, I mean, it's great to listen to CDs and stuff, but watching music live is such a different experience than listening to it at home. And I think, do you know who Johnny Lang is?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
So I saw him play here at Melody Tent many years ago, and this guy, just, you can see it, like, comes from his soul when he plays. It's just really fun to watch because you can just see it's like he becomes one with his instrument, and it's amazing. And I think about that sometimes when I'm listening to him. But like the blues, for example, I don't care what blues artist it is, they're way better in person than when you listen to them on a CD.
Well, so there's two. I want to, you know, as a scientist, my job is lumping and splitting, which things go together and which should be split apart. So let's split apart here the visual impact from the live impact. because you can watch Johnny Lang on video at home, and True. It's not the same as being there
True.
Live. You can
That's
still
right.
see the facial expression and all the soul there.
Yep.
But the thing about live is that anything could happen. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's going to happen. And he doesn't know what's going to happen. And it's an act of joint discovery between the performer and the audience, and a good performer will feed off the audience. I've been very fortunate because for the last 15 years, I've had a mentor in this audience relationship stuff, a guy named Victor Wooten, with whom I perform and have toured. He's a bass player. He's better known perhaps as a member of Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, but he really knows how to read an audience, and he knows how to take in their expectations without them speaking them. And then we modify what we play.
So what is it you hope people take away from the book?
You know, I launched the book in Massachusetts at the Boston Museum of Science. And the day I launched it, the best possible outcome happened. A representative of the governor's office came and announced that as of last year, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is offering free vouchers for 12 arts therapy sessions for anyone in Massachusetts. Maybe you have to be a taxpayer, I don't know, but maybe not anyone. Maybe not somebody comes over from New Hampshire, but and they can use it for therapy or for preventative therapy. And that to me is the best outcome, that Medicare, health insurance companies, hospitals, governments will see that music is a cost-effective way of dealing with a range of problems. And just to hit on one of the cost-effective examples in the book, this probably makes the case better than anything. If you go in for surgery and they're going to have to anesthetize you, in most cases, they'll give you some sort of a relaxant, muscle relaxant, you know, anti-anxiety drug, because it turns out being relaxed is different than being knocked out, and they want your body to be relaxed and, you know, low heart rate variability and all that stuff. So they'll typically give you a Valium. And that Valium, if you went to the corner drugstore and bought it yourself, might be $5. In the hospital, on average in the United States, it's $750. Okay. Same pill, same strength. Huge markup. And hospital administrators don't want you to know this, but it's like booze at a restaurant. That's their profit center. They can't make money on anything else. They got all this fancy equipment and expensive doctors. They make the money on the drugs. But I report on studies that show that people in an operating theater prior to the surgery, if they're given music instead of Valium, their recovery is just as good and sometimes better. And every marker we have of physiological relaxation is equal to the Valium or better. And music's non-addictive and it's cheaper.
The book is I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Daniel Levitin, thank you so much. What a fun hour. Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.